This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
To the list of trending technology companies behind Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, go ahead and add Splunk. Big data. I'm telling you, that's where the money is. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is brought to you by Gazelle.com. Gazelle buys the used iPhones, iPads, Macs, smartphones, and other gadgets from your home or office, so you can upgrade to the latest versions of your favorite gadgets. Find out what your gadget is worth at Gazelle.com. Don't just sell it, Gazelle it.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Friday, the 20th of April. Good to have you with us. Boy, there is nothing the markets like more than a good initial public offering, right? Preferably some hot technology company, maybe a mobile app or something. Profits, of course, optional. Ideally with a CEO barely old enough to have a beer. Sadly, that's not what we've got for you today. The best IPO of 2012 is a company called Splunk. Shares doubled when they went on sale yesterday. It's got nothing to do with social media. The CEO has been in the technology business longer than Mark Zuckerberg has been alive, but yet Splunk may just be onto something. The dull and boring end of high tech, if you will. What's starting to be called big data. Marketplace's Queenie Kim reports.
It's no secret that companies track just about everything we do these days. The movie tickets we buy, the restaurants we visit, and where we shop for shoes. And they use all that data to sell us just the perfect thing. That's the idea, anyway. Rebecca Lieb is a digital advertising analyst at Altimeter Group. She says the reality is that many companies are just drowning in data.
It is impossible to manage or understand this vast collection of data without very complex and large technical solutions.
And that's where companies like Splunk come in. They analyze what's known as big data to make it easier for companies to use. Splunk helps gaming companies like Zynga understand how people play its games. Michael Chui follows big data from McKinsey Global Institute. He says it's not just data gatherers like Facebook and Google that need big data services. More and more smaller companies need them too.
The average company with over 1,000 employees in the United States has more data available to it than exists in the U.S. Library of Congress.
Startups like Splunk are putting big data on the radar. But that could change, said Heidi Messer, who runs a big data company in New York.
My prediction is in 5 years, no one's going to even be talking about big data because it's just going to be the way you do business.
And investors are betting it'll be big business. I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
President Obama's doing the college tour next week. Yeah, no, not that kind of college tour. I think his kids are still a little young for that. This one is a swing through three states that are going to get a whole lot of attention in the campaign this fall. And the president's going to be talking student loans at universities in North Carolina, Colorado, and Iowa. He's doing it because interest rates on new federal student loans are set to double on July the 1st. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has the story.
The law that cut interest rates on federal student loans 5 years ago is set to expire this summer. And if Congress does nothing, the rate jumps from 3.4% to 6.8% when mortgage and other consumer loans are bargain basement low. Financial aid expert Mark Kantrowitz says, remember, it costs the government billions a year to subsidize student loans. And besides, they're riskier.
If you default on a home equity loan, the lender can foreclose upon your home. If you default on a student loan, the government can't repossess your education.
That's no doubt cold comfort to the millions of low and middle income students who depend on so-called Stafford loans every year. Rich Williams is the higher education advocate for US PIRG.
As we're trying to find ways to recover from the economic slump we're in, we want to present every green light possible to students and Americans to go to school to get the training that will make them competitive in the marketplace.
But Mark Kantrowitz says it's not the interest rate on student loans that dissuades kids from going to college.
What matters with regard to whether someone enrolls in college is how much money can they get and when do they have to start paying it back.
But with student debt levels at nearly $1 trillion, education experts agree higher interest rates will hurt students after graduation. Already there's evidence that rising student debt means many young people are putting off major economic decisions, everything from buying houses to having babies. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
A note from yesterday's program now. I goofed when I said Katie Couric was on Good Morning America last week, and that is why GMA at long last beat the Today Show in the all-important morning news ratings. She was actually on 2 weeks ago, just to be clear. On Wall Street today, oh, it could have been such a better outcome. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A moment now, or 4 minutes of live radio anyway, to talk about the week that was. We've rounded up two of our usual suspects today, our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore and Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so we go to the front page of the New York Times, Heidi, and I'm just going to read the headline, and I would like you to discuss, compare and contrast, and do all that stuff you do. You ready?
Do I get a blue book?
No essays, just conversation. So here we go. Literally, the lead headline in the New York Times today is, "Fears rise that recovery may falter in the spring." The question is, come on, really?
Yeah, that headline should have been, "Why did we ever get our hopes up?"
Right? Oh, so, ooh, snap. Okay.
Yeah, because, you know, there were, as things seemed to be looking better, there was an amount of caution that we all needed to have. People were worried, for instance, let's take unemployment, right? Unemployment seemed to look really good for the past 3 months, and then it didn't. It looked terrible. And we went up on that high, and we came down low again. We didn't, and people had warned us, there could be problems with these numbers. This is seasonal. We didn't listen. And this is the suffering within, the suffering afterwards. But you know what? Nothing has really changed all that much. You know, it's just that how we're interpreting it has changed.
All right. Well, so Cardiff, interpret Europe for me then, because one of the things that Annie Lowrey talks about in this article in the Times is how European debt woes are coming back. Look at Spain and all of that stuff. So help me out.
Sure. So overall, I find myself in the really unfamiliar position of being optimistic. And that's not something that's been normal for the last couple of years. But Europe is still the most complicated part of this. So right now, the immediate issue is obviously to alleviate fears of what's happening in Spain and what's happening in Italy and then later on Portugal. Yeah. And it's still really unclear what's going to happen there. In terms of its impact on us, though, I think there's less reason to be worried about than before. And to go back to what Heidi was saying, she's absolutely right that we should have been a little bit more cautious all along. It's become incredibly frustrating to discern in real time the direction of the U.S. economy. But if there's one lesson we've learned from the last 2 years when we've seen a similar pattern, it's that things were never quite as bad as we thought in the worst parts of the recovery, but they were never quite as good as we thought either in the best parts. It's just what we've had is a slow, steadily accelerating recovery, something that it's not moving nearly as fast as we wish, but at the same time, it is getting better. And if you look at some other numbers, if you look at incomes, are still higher than last year. We are creating more jobs than we used to be. So a lot of people were disappointed with the last report. But even 7 months ago, that would have been considered
it would have been great.
No,
right.
Report.
Exactly. But yeah, but let me ask you guys this. Are we not then ever supposed to get our hopes up? I mean, is that what I hear you saying, Heidi?
Why don't we just wait for enough evidence? What's wrong with that?
Why don't you have some hope? Oh, come on. How do you get through the day?
I mean, no, we should have hope. You know what? We should have hope because this is, I mean, for all the reasons that you start playing the Star Spangled Banner, right? Like that this is a great country and we know how to innovate. We have a great history and there are many amazing things happening right now in industries like manufacturing that we wouldn't have expected. The tech industry is innovating every day. Healthcare, biotech, all of that. Those are the reasons we can be optimistic. But if we tie our fortune to arbitrary numbers and we get disappointed. I mean, why?
Yeah,
we should blame ourselves.
Fair enough. All right. So, Cardiff, let me ask you sort of the flip side question. That is, if the regular economy for actual everyday people is still a little soft and sagging, what are we to make then of corporate profits and, you know, corporate America doing reasonably well still?
Yeah, and corporate profits has been sort of one of the bright spots, and yet it hasn't translated into jobs the last few years. And
right,
That's been somewhat dispiriting. That being said, one of the reasons that's happened is because companies have been afraid to hire, so they've been squeezing more and more out of their workers.
Right.
But they're realizing that they might have hit the limit to that, and recently that's changed. So if you look at the productivity numbers, they're actually going down, but for the right reasons, I think. So actually, that's another reason why I am sort of very, very cautiously optimistic. That being said, it's going to take a while. I think things will continue getting better unless the policymakers driving the bus take us off the cliff again, right?
That could happen. Right. Don't even go to the policymakers. Right. I mean, that's, you know, the whole politics of the economy is a whole nother thing. And we've got seven more months to talk about that. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FD Alphaville and Heidi Moore in our New York studios. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks,
Kai. Have a good weekend. Speaking of elections and the seven more months of it that we have in this country, it's the first round of presidential elections in France this weekend, Sunday. Nicolas Sarkozy and nine other candidates are on the ballot. Immigration is a big deal for voters over there. The European debt crisis also. And unemployment, specifically in France, for 20 and 30-somethings. And that, the unemployment, has given activists over there an idea. A grassroots ratings agency that evaluates the candidates' plans to deal with joblessness. It's called Young and Poor's, after Standard and Poor's, you get it? And it says none of the candidates in France are anywhere near a AAA rating. John Lawrenson reports now from Paris.
28-year-old Ophélie Latil is, unfortunately, a typical case.
I made 2 years of internship, unpaid internship, of course.
But it wasn't your normal unpaid internship. Ophélie says she managed five workers who were all in their 40s. And she had a special skill the company needed. She was the only one who spoke Croatian. But apparently, even this wasn't enough.
I was working all day long on the weekends, on the evenings, because I was thinking that I would be hired. And of course, at the end, they said, you are very good, so could you have 6 months of internship again?
Ophélie refused, saying she needed to earn some money to pay the rent, to buy food. So she left, and another intern took her place. One in five French people are out of work. Even more are on internships. That leaves almost half of French 16 to 34-year-olds without paid work. Which is why Ophélie came up with the idea of Young and Poor's with co-founder Gaëtan Mortier.
We were recently looking for a new initiative to put pressures on presidential candidates, and we thought the best idea would be to create a rating agency, but not working for shareholders, but rather working for citizens.
Sur des questions de la longueur et de la qualité. Presidential candidate Jacques Cheminade replies to a question on TV asked by Young and Poor's. Most of the candidates refused similar invitations. Sociology professor Louis Chauvel, who sits on the panel of experts that decides Young and Poor's ratings, these refusals are revealing.
In the US, there is a debate about generation limbo. Well-educated young graduates at age 25, 30-something who are not able to find their own place in society. In France, we have had this kind of problem for the last 30 years with absolutely no answer, no consciousness, and no capacity of French political leaders to tackle this real problem.
Chauvel and the other Young and Poor's experts have given a D rating to Nicolas Sarkozy. A timid recovery spurred by his free market reforms was crushed by the world recession. And Young and Poor's says deregulation has left young workers more vulnerable to employer abuse. Sarkozy's socialist rival, François Hollande, has a B rating. He promises to implement a new government job creation scheme. To get its message out, Young and Poor's even takes its protest to the street. Ophélie Gaëtan and the others on Paris's most prestigious avenue, the Champs-Élysées, try to persuade shoppers to boycott a store because it replaced a woman on maternity leave with an intern. Young and Poor's has been up and running for a month, so is it making any impact on voters? Well, the most popular candidate with young voters is Marine Le Pen. Young and Poor's gave that anti-immigration candidate a D rating. In Paris, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Coming up, you drill, baby, drill, and then this happens.
That actually was the largest oil discovery in the United States onshore in 30 years.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 65 points today. That's about a 0.5%, closed at 13,029. The NASDAQ off 7 points, 0.25%, and even 3,000. The S&P 500 tacked on 1 point, 0.1%, ended things at 1,378. For the week gone by, the Dow added 1.4%. The NASDAQ gave back 0.4%. The S&P 500 up 0.6%. Good earnings news today for some bellwether stocks. Microsoft powered up 4.5%. Oil field contractor Schlumberger spurted up 2.75%. General Electric charged 1% higher. McDonald's piled on 0.75% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.97%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is brought to you by Gazelle.com. Gazelle buys the used gadgets from your home or office, such as iPhones, iPads, iPods, Macs, or smartphones, so you can upgrade to the latest versions. At Gazelle.com, see what your used gadget is worth. Then mail it to Gazelle for free. Gazelle pays for the shipping, and you'll get paid fast. Gazelle helps you upgrade to the latest gadgets faster and gives you value for the used gadgets you replace. Find out what your used gadgets are worth at Gazelle.com. Don't just sell it, gazelle it.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, President Obama is scheduled to speak at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. It's the final week of the Centennial Cherry Blossom Festival in the nation's capital, celebrating the gift of 3,000 Japanese cherry trees in 1912. And actress Shirley Temple turns 84. Celebrate with a little pink drink with a cherry. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We're going to do a single topic mailbag today, a commentary from earlier this week about us, public radio, and who ought to pay for it. Tucker Carlson, the editor of The Daily Caller, offered his thoughts.
I love public radio. I listen to it every day. But sometimes, as I drive to my white-collar job in my expensive foreign car, surrounded by fellow public radio listeners driving to their white-collar jobs in their expensive foreign cars, I feel a little guilty.
I just heard the segment on paying more for public radio as I was driving my six-year-old domestic car.
I do drive an import, but it's a rusty 94 and leaks when it rains.
Public radio listeners tend to have household incomes more than $30,000 above the national average. They're also whiter, better educated, and more than twice as likely as ordinary Americans to work in top management.
I did not appreciate being told what I am and am not.
I'm living on Social Security disability. I depend on public radio both for news and for company, since I spend most days home by myself.
To say that the only people who listen to public radio are wealthy white people is so racist.
All of us are pretty affluent, I think to myself. Do we really need a federal subsidy?
From my point of view, public radio is a small but significant tool I use to get to the upper middle class.
We remember how it was before we had Marfa Public Radio. We do not wish to return to those days of nothing, but without federal funding, our radio station will cease to exist.
What happened to doing things for the public good?
Public radio listeners certainly could pay the whole tab for public radio. They just don't want to. Maybe, just to be decent, we should start.
So yes, I can defend my tax dollars supporting public radio with a straight face, all 0.00014% of them.
Perhaps your commentator should just pay more himself and not guilt trip the rest of us who can't.
That was Dan Epp, Tom Davis, Diana Cole, Joan Dahlberg, Carlos Murillo, Barbara Hines, Raymond Anthony, and Tori Douglas. Crude oil closed today in New York at $103.05 a barrel, up just a hair. Monday, it's going to be, I don't know, it's going to be whatever the market says it's going to be, because there is nothing, actually, about oil that is a sure thing. Least of all, finding it. Companies spend hundreds of millions of dollars leasing land and drilling wells based on what is basically some very educated guesswork. The biggies like BP and Chevron go drilling all over the world. But there are hundreds of smaller companies poking around right here in the United States looking for the next big find. Alex Chadwick, the host of the public radio series Burn, an energy journal, has the story of one of them.
I'm following Sid Jansma Jr. across the steel grid deck of Patterson Oil Derrick number 176.
What we'll do is we'll walk up these steps so you can see the drilling floor.
Sid has been leasing the rig for 3 years, or rather his company has, Wolverine Gas and Oil. This well is Covenant 20-5, 14,000 feet deep. It cost Wolverine $21,350,513 and change. That's a lot of numbers, but they matter. The oil business is all data and some luck, and more of both is always better. And you see the product of all this about a half mile farther along Utah Route 24, where Sid shows me a modest arrangement of pipes emerging from the ground in a small area closed off by chest-high chain-link fence.
This discovery well was drilled and actually discovered oil on December 24, 2003. I will never forget that.
This well is Covenant 17-1, and no, he won't forget it. Utah has a lot of gas and oil, and for about 40 years, mineral rights around Richfield were leased by a couple of the bigs, Chevron and Phillips. They drilled 5 wells decades ago. One cost $17 million, a lot of money for the early 70s, and they got nothing. And after a while, they quit looking. Chevron kept the leases, though. Oil companies do that. A generation passed, and then about a dozen years ago, maybe in a fit of clearing the books, Chevron decided to unload Richfield, and someone from the company called Sid Jansma.
Well, I got the call from Chevron because I was working 30 miles north of here on another project, and they were just wanting to find somebody to write a check out for their acreage. I told them I had enough acreage. I had 40,000 acres of my own. Why would I buy their 80,000? But I'm curious.
It happened that Wolverine's exploration manager had once worked for Chevron, and he knew this area of Utah. He already knew some of the features. Leases are priced per acre. This was 80,000 acres. Chevron was asking $2, $160,000 total.
So I bought the acreage from Chevron, and then we did a whole lot of studies for 2 years and figured out we wanted to drill right here, and that's when we drilled the well.
Right here in this spot.
Right here in this spot.
How big a company are you in the oil business?
My company, Wolverine, is very small. We have a total of 45 employees all over the United States. That's it. However, what's interesting for people to know is companies like myself own 85% of all of the oil and gas wells in the United States, and we produce over 50% of all of the oil and gas in the continental United States.
The site where Sid had been drilling, 30 miles away, that wasn't for oil. It was for something called coal methane, a kind of gas. Wolverine geoscientists looked at the Richfield data, and they made a highly educated guess.
We thought there was a high probability that there was gas in it, not oil.
When you say high probability, you're an oil man. What does high probability mean? 10%, 20%?
Oh, thanks for asking that. Yeah, a high probability means it had about a 5 to 10% probability that there was oil, and probably 5%.
I'm leaving out some really big parts, like the financing. Sid trying to get partners to buy in because nobody wants to go into this alone. Spread the risk. He got turned down 64 times, but finally he's got the partners, and it's December 2003.
Mind you, the well starts out at zero and then goes 1 foot, 2 foot, 5,000, and so forth. As we were drilling at 5,838 feet, we started getting shows of oil.
Data. A show of oil is a tiny hydrocarbon signal in the deep earth that the drill brings up. They are too small to see, but the engineers test everything, and the instruments can read it.
So we decided finally at about 6,400 feet to tell them to quit drilling and go in and run electric logs in the hole. It's a special electric tool that tells you what's in the rock. And when we ran the special electric tool in, it was, wow, there's a lot of oil in that rock. As a matter of fact, there's a whole lot of oil in that rock.
It was not the gas that they had hoped for. It was a very high grade of crude oil and about 100 million barrels of it.
So we were stuck with having an oil discovery at 5,800 feet that actually was the largest oil discovery in the United States onshore in 30 years.
Wolverine has spent the past decade drilling another 14 wells in the search for another find. 13 were dry. That's the oil business. But in the quiet, graceful hills outside Richfield, Utah, those 100 million barrels of oil that Wolverine found, well, don't bother. I'll do the math. At $100 each, it's worth $10 billion. And that's the oil business. And about 1 month ago now, Wolverine decided to start giving up some of the leases it's been holding in the Richfield area. It'll keep the Covenant Field, of course, but probably stop exploring for more. Someone else can get a try, Sid told me. And when I asked if he really thinks someone else will come in, even with Wolverine getting out, Sid replies with complete certainty. Oh yeah, they will. And that is the oil business too. I'm Alex Chadwick for Marketplace.
Alex is the host of the public radio series Burn, an energy journal. It's from Sound Vision Productions and produced in association with American Public Media. Special thanks to the National Science Foundation as well.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, the governor of Utah signed a bill this week making gold and silver legal tender. We were kind of curious about exactly how that might work, so we called Craig Franco. He runs a company called the Utah Gold and Silver Depository. It's a bank, kind of. So just to be clear, this law does not let me take a nugget of gold and plop it down on a corner and buy a pair of jeans and a candy bar, right?
That is correct. The law is very specific on the type of gold product that's been monetized. And what has been monetized is American gold and silver coinage.
Printed by or minted by who? The United States Mint?
The United States federal government.
So I could have some 1792 gold double eagle walking liberty coin, whatever they call them, because you guys do special stuff, right? And plop it down on the counter?
Theoretically, yes. Now, and practically, that's impossible to do. So what we've done at Utah Gold and Silver Depository is we have developed a debit card that allows for people to deposit their gold and silver like you would deposit cash in a bank.
Yeah.
And we can issue a debit card against the value of your gold and silver holdings.
I have to tell you, that takes literally all the charm out of it, man. Right. Gold in New York today, by the way, $1,643 an ounce. So go ahead, take your chances. All right, that's it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow added 65 points, about 0.5%, 13,029 the number. The NASDAQ off 7 points, 0.25%, 3,000. Even the S&P 500 inched up 1 point, 0.1%, ended things at 1,378. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, hiking, kayaking, and balancing your checkbook, the Girl Scouts, and financial literacy.
A lawyer, principal, or a psychologist. Animal researcher of some sort, biologist, and park ranger, yeah.
I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.